Hello, everyone, and welcome to the call. It's 5 o'clock here in San Francisco, and I'm on the line with Gina Schatz, and thank you all so much for showing up for this call. I'm really excited to talk to Gina today, and we'll tell you a little bit more about how we met and stuff like that. But first of all, I just wanted to, as always, remind you that wherever you are listening to this as much as possible, if you could bring your attention to this conversation, to be with us, as if we were all in a room together, you know, because in some sense we are all in one container on this call, and it would be really great to, you know, even though we can't see you physically, but if we can just all feel that we're all connected for the, you know, next hour or so that we're going to be together, to learn from Gina and learn from each other, possibly, like, as questions come up. And that's one of the things you should know is that, you know, questions are always welcome in this format. That's why we do these calls live, and it's not just a podcast that I put out, you know, with just me interviewing the person. So we really encourage you to share about what's coming up for you during the call and like that. So just ask you to, you know, if you can shut your Facebook chat down for the moment and, you know, not check your email, and just be with us as much as you can and enjoy the call. And also definitely please, at any point, you can hit one on your keypad to ask a question. And we can also do things, I didn't even tell Gina this, but Gina, if you do have a question where you want to ask people things on a scale, like from, you know, on a scale from 1 to 5, we can do polls and things like that as well. I forgot to mention that to you. But this software is pretty cool, and you can also put people in breakout groups and things like that. So first of all, let me just welcome you, Gina, to the call. Thanks for taking time out of your day to join us here and be part of the Telesummit. And it's really great to have somebody that I'd never known before be part of this now. You know, it's like one of the first times I've done that where I met someone in a totally non-yogic setting, if such things exist. But I was at a business conference and I'd written about this in the email. I think I was eating my lunch and writing an email, and I think I might have been hearing an email for this very list. About being at the Money 2.0 conference, and I overheard somebody who was obviously on Skype, like looking at a computer, talking about very, you know, precise anatomical adjustments and movements and how to do some kind of, you know, movement readjustment and patterning to help somebody heal. And I was like, what is this person doing? This is so intriguing, because since I work online and I'm in the yoga space, I've always wondered, like, how much actual online yoga teaching is going on in a way that's that personal and that specific. It's not just a general, you know, let's talk about the basic principles using a webinar of anatomy. Like, of course, I can imagine that. But to see someone doing something one-on-one, or I think it was 1 to 2, to see that happening in real time was pretty cool, or at least to eavesdrop over it. So I just went up to her afterwards. I was like, hey, who are you and what are you doing? And the other thing is that Gina, I didn't know her name at the time, but Gina was like, she clearly knew her stuff so well, like knew her anatomy, like as well as anyone I'd ever heard, like talking about those things. So I was kind of impressed by that too. But I used to be a bit of an anatomy geek, and I feel like it's a little bit like a foreign language, whereas if you don't use it, you kind of forget it all. So now I feel like I'm not nearly where I used to be. But I knew enough to know that she knew what she was doing. So Gina, welcome. Thanks again for joining us, and I'd just love for you to say hi and share a little bit about, you know, what – let me ask you a question, I guess, before, because just saying hi is kind of boring. I would love to know, like, what – because that's usually what I do. I'm trying to get better as I go in these telesummits, you know. Usually I'm like, say hi, and then the person's like, hi, and then it's, like, awkward. So I'd love you to say hi and also share about what you know, people listening to this call, like, what's possible for them when they begin to learn, they need to learn the Schatz method, but when you begin to learn about the body in the way that you've been studying and practicing and teaching, like, what's possible for them as teachers? So that, you know, we talked about that when people are, a lot of teachers, especially early on, and sometimes even as we become more experienced, when we're faced with students that are injured, it can be, it doesn't always bring up like a great sensation in us internally. It's not, we don't always feel like we can help. Sometimes we just want to kind of do no harm. And I'd be curious from your point of view, like what's possible beyond that? You know, if that's the baseline, it's like, okay, do no harm. What's possible beyond for us as yoga teachers? What can we do to like actually help people?
Oh, that's a really rich question. I love it. And I do want to say hi, officially, hi. And just to let you know that I am honored to be among a crew of amazingly talented teachers that have come before me on Yoga Teacher Telesummit. So thank you so much for having me. I'm equally excited. And I have to say, Talat, I remember exactly when we met, and I remember specifically the call that I was on. I had a client in Cleveland who had injured his ankle, and I wasn't there. Obviously, I was with you in New Jersey, so I needed to get him some help. So you were actually witnessing the very beginnings of the SHOTS method becoming available electronically. I used to think that I had to be in the room with someone because my hands were at the end of my wrist, so how else could I help them if I wasn't physically there? And amazingly, technology is helping us really branch out, so I'm excited about that. But I didn't know that you used to refer to yourself as an anatomy geek. I'm the only one that I know that refers to myself as an anatomy geek. That's kind of exciting. We have more in common than I remembered.
Yeah, I mean, I just took one of those, like, after my teacher training, I went to one of those, like, anatomy. The teacher was a total amazing anatomy teacher, and I went and took, like two full, you know, courses on the body, and it was, like, so in-depth, it blew my mind, and I was like, wow, I don't know anything. You know, you think you know something in the beginning? Like after your first, well, maybe since you started a different path, but most people listening, you know, you do like your first teacher training, you're like, wow, I know the body so well now, you know. But then you actually go study with somebody who studies anatomy, and you're just like, whoa, I don't know anything. You know, that's kind of what I did.
Yeah, but, you know, I think that's really normal because I've been taking anatomy for over 20 years now, and every time I go into a new course, there's that feeling of being a freshman again, right? Mm-hmm. And that's when you know that you're in a good class because you're learning something new. And you know, this machine that we're walking around in is the number one miracle on the planet. So for us to feel like we know it all would be misleading at best, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Hopefully every time we're in the presence of somebody who knows something about this magnificent thing we're walking around in, we do feel like we don't really know it yet, so that we can come to know ourselves again and again and again. That's what we do on our mat. Right, we come to know ourselves again and again and again, mm-hmm. and then do it in a different way. So I like to think of anatomy in the same way. And that's really where the fun part for me is in the teaching, that if we can make anatomy approachable and exciting and come to it with an air of curiosity instead of like, oh, my God, I don't know those terms. I'm going to be blown out of the water in this class. If we can bring the curiosity back, it'll be more approachable and more people, especially yoga teachers, will come to know more anatomy. That's where we get our strength from as teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that's kind of leading into what your question is, like what's possible for us.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the more we know about the body and how it moves and how it responds to pain and what it does with injury, the more we know about that, the more effective we can become as yoga teachers, as any practitioner, really. And the more confidence we have around what the body does and how it responds, the more we can be of service, right? So I believe that deep down, or maybe not even that deep down, people who choose to become yoga teachers want to be of service. You know, they want to be change agents and be part of the change. They want to lead masses into a healthier way of thinking and being and moving. And the more we know about what's going on in the physical part of the asana, the more confidence we can have to actually be of service to make that change occur. And so what I've experienced as a body worker, so I've been a body worker now for 19 years, and I was a body worker before I was a yogi, and I was a dance teacher and a dance student before I was a yogi. So I have a real vested interest in how the body moves, how it moves efficiently, what happens when there's injuries, how that compensates particular movement back into my dance days, and also, you know, how to help people get rid of those injuries, right? As a body worker, that was my job. People come in, they don't feel well physically, and my job is to hopefully alleviate all or most of that for them. And what I find in yoga is that there isn't enough understanding about really what happens when the body's injured. So there's this deficit of knowledge, and what ends up happening is that yoga teachers then become less confident, when really what we want is for them to become more confident so that they can help more people get on the mat, do the movements that they need, and make the changes. And so when we know more about injuries and how they manifest in the body and what that does to an asana practice, we can move through a yoga class with a variety of students and be able to help all of them. And that's really important to me. When I was doing body work and dance before my yoga career had come to be, I had clients coming in with injuries, and they were telling me that they were getting injured in a yoga class. And I didn't understand that because, A, I didn't know the asanas, and B, I really thought that yoga was designed to heal the body. So when I was getting this plethora of people coming in with seemingly the same injuries over and over again, I really had this question mark looming. I just didn't get it. And so for a variety of reasons, I went into the yoga world to try to figure out what all that was about and explore it and learn asana for myself. And I figured it out, right? And it went right back to what I know as a body worker, that the way the body moves through injury and through compensation is not the way it moves optimally. So if we could know the difference, we could know what optimal movement is, and we can understand clearly and thoroughly what happens when the body compensates and when it's injured, we can actually move our students from pain and injury into optimal movement so that they can do their yoga practice and make the changes that we're hoping for them. So what's the limit? What's the possibility beyond the just do no harm? The possibility is endless, right? Like mm-hmm. we can literally change someone's life and their entire experience if we know more about anatomy and how the body works through injury.
Right.
Literally no limit. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's exciting. You know, I mean, I feel like I'm not alone in having had many injuries throughout. I mean, I brought many injuries to my practice of asana. Like, in fact, that's why I came to yoga, like so many people, like having gotten injured doing something else when I came to yoga. But the truth is I also got injured practicing yoga, you know, and
okay.
I think that's not as uncommon as we might kind of hope or want to believe. And I'm curious, you know, to know from your perspective, like when you look out into the world of teacher trainings that's out there, and again, this is not to like, you know, to put down any teacher trainings that are out there, but it's just, you know, like 200-hour training, you know, there's not that much time spent on it. I mean, the person I studied, my first teacher training was pretty anatomy-centric, and yet even then, as I said, when I went to an actual anatomy class, I was like, well, I don't know anything. And so I'm just curious to get your perspective on, you know, what would you, for teachers that are out there now, like what's your recommendation for them for continuing their education to become more proficient in working with people that are injured? And, you know, what does that really take? I mean, obviously, we're not going to do it on this call. It's not like, all right, once you're done on this call, you're good to handle any injury. Obviously, there's some course of study involved, but just so people have a sense of, you know, what kind of commitment it takes or what kind of time it takes to actually become really well-versed in how to work with people and from all different, you know, walks of life and with all different kinds of body issues. Like, what's your sense of that? And I feel like sometimes in the yoga world there's a little bit of this leaning towards, like, this system has a bunch of ways to work with the body that can feel a little bit like quick fixes that don't always work for everyone. They can work for some people, but they maybe don't work for all people. And so I'm just curious, from your perspective, like what corrective would you offer to that?
Mm. So you brought up some really amazing things, right? Like, I think you nailed it on the head. Continuing education should be starred on the top of everyone's page if they're taking notes right now. And I say that with a ton of enthusiasm and excitement, actually, because I teach currently for Yoga Alliance 200-hour yoga teacher trainings. And I've done that for about 8 years now. I absolutely love it. I talk very fast when I'm teaching, and still it's only 20 hours, right? And I know about body, I know about injury, and I know about yoga, and I know how all three of those things are connected. And even still, to the best of my ability, I can't get all of that transferred over into the minds of the yoga teachers in training in 20 hours. It's not possible. So it doesn't mean that the 200-hour level is not sufficient. It doesn't mean that Yoga Alliance is doing something wrong. It doesn't mean anything like that. What it means is that it's a beginning point, right? So when I went to school, it seems like a million years ago now, and I took my first anatomy class, I didn't stop there. Like, I've been taking anatomy classes for the entirety of my career, and I'm still learning every day. I mean, I just took classes in the fall of 2010, and I learned so much stuff. I have like 5 notebooks full of notes, and I've been taking anatomy for a couple decades, right? So the idea really is, like, go to your teacher training, get as much out of it as you possibly can, and know that that's a starting point. I don't know anyone who's had any degree or certification in any training where once they get their degree, they think they know it all. Well, hopefully they don't, right? Because that's a fallacy. We all need to know more so that we can become experts in our field. And I think that's why you and I are actually on the phone, because we're talking about people who want to take their training and then become experts. And part of being an expert is knowing a wide range of information, which is far more than what a 20-hour anatomy portion can give you in a yoga teacher training. And something that you said, that, you know, some corrective measures don't work for everyone, that's ultimately how I ended up designing my method, because as a body worker, right, that's where I started, I was also going on to continuing education, and I was learning the next latest and greatest modality. Oh, this is the one that fixes everything. This is the one that takes care of 80% of your client's pain. This is how you can transform your practice, all that. And I went, and a lot of it was really fantastic stuff. And then I would take it back into my treatment room, and I would work on my clients and find out that it wasn't really working for everyone. It was covering maybe 6 out of 10 people. Well, that's not enough of a percentage for me to feel successful or like an expert. I needed more. So then I'd go to the next continuing education class and learn the next great modality and add that tool to my toolbox. And what I ended up discovering is that I needed, as a practitioner, to have a wide range of tools in my toolbox, so that no matter who came into me, I could help them, right? So if I started with a hammer and they weren't a nail, I could pound on them forever. It wasn't going to take care of their pain. Maybe I needed to be a screwdriver because they had a different shape of a problem or their body responded differently. And so what I did in my method was I took all of those different modalities and I put them together. It's not one method. It's a blend of many different methods from a wide range of backgrounds based on how I've experienced the body moves and responds to pain and injury. So I agree with you. There isn't one fix for everyone, and those of us who are on a path towards excellence know that instinctively, and continuing education is definitely part of the path to get us there.
Mm-hmm. Great. So if you were going to say, like, you know, for all the people that are listening in live right now and those that will listen to the replay of this call, if there were, you know, one or two or three, you know, if there were things that you were going to tell them to take to heart as far as, you know, from your education and experience and the ones who are listening and who are teachers and also even the ones who are students for themselves to learn about their own bodies, like, what would you say beyond, you know, the need for continuing education and to really learn how the body works on a deeper level than perhaps just the general idea of, like, the systems in the body that, you know, you can kind of understand from your teacher training. But what is it from this call, perhaps, if you could, you know, speak to each person individually on this call and just sit them down for, you know, 5 minutes or 10 minutes? Like, what would you tell them that you think would have the biggest impact for them in terms of how they could feel addressing students with issues in their classes and also teaching in a way that is more likely to enhance somebody's well-being and vitality rather than have somebody, you know, get into a compromising position or hold something that's not comfortable for them? Or, you know, I mean, ultimately everyone's responsible for their own actions, but what can we do from our side to be 100% responsible for our part of it as teachers? What's the best way we can, you know, show up in the classroom and teach and also serve our students?
Right. So it's assumed that everyone that's on this call has an interest in injuries so that their minds are more orthopedically tuned towards their students' needs. And so I'm going to speak to that. And what I will say is that there's no way to jump past the 20 hours of anatomy in yoga teacher training and get to therapeutics right away. Because there has to be an understanding of how the body works together. I mean, the body itself, by definition, is yoga. It's a union of systems. They don't work separately. They all impact each other. And you need to have an understanding of that so that when you're dealing with someone with an injury or a pathology, meaning something's not optimally working, we need to know what optimal is so that we can see where they are and take them back to it. So there's no real way to jump past that initial 20 hours. So I want everybody to know that the 20 hours of anatomy that they took was well worth it. And then the way to enhance themselves as teachers regarding injuries in their class is to know more about functional anatomy and kinesiology, meaning like the way the body moves, which is more than just muscle identification. There's a part of muscle identification that's really important, but it's also like how does it move in relation to the other connective tissue? And when it's not moving optimally, what could possibly be going wrong? So how the body moves and responds to movement is really important to know so that when something's not going right, we have another way to address it. And another way to address it isn't always just giving them an adaptation for the pose. Sometimes it's actually identifying that there's something that could be going wrong, right? And when you can offer that as a yoga teacher, that there could be something going wrong or when someone needs to be referred out to some other source, like a body worker, for example, then your students begin to trust you. They trust that you're knowledgeable. They trust that you have their well-being at heart, and they trust that you're going to guide them in the right direction, even if it means out of your class temporarily and into a treatment room so that you can come back to class and be safe. When you can earn their trust, you've become, it's invaluable. You've become their guru. I would also say that the nature of injuries is really important, so how the body becomes injured and what it does when there's already an injury there before they get to your yoga class. So we're not assuming that everybody's going to come into your yoga class and get injured. We're actually assuming the opposite. But like you even mentioned, Tal, earlier, that you got into yoga because you had a pre-existing injury, and then you went into yoga and then somehow became injured. And what comes to mind for me immediately is I wonder how much of your pre-existing injury participated in how you then became injured in yoga. Because the body will compensate and you'll stop using it optimally. So it looks like perhaps that you're doing the pose pretty well okay, but really what you're doing is kind of hampering the body from a previous injury, and that can create a whole host of repatterning that several classes down the line, several months, several weeks later, can register as a new injury. And you might not even know that they're related at first. But that's what I do. That's what we do in my workshops, is identify how one can definitely equal the other, and here's the path that it took. You got to slow it down and know the nature of injuries and how they move through the body and how they register. And then I guess the third thing I would say is how the body compensates and how to identify those patterns is really important. So knowing that the body can compensate and knowing that there's patterns there and that they may need to be referred out for something else in addition to their yoga is really important. But if you can, as a yoga teacher, actually know how to identify those patterns, so you can say to your student, oh, I see, this hip is a little bit more rotated than the other one. That's probably why it's pulling on your knee. And they go, oh, my gosh, how do you know I have a knee problem? Well, I can see it because it's right here. And then the next thing the student says is, can you fix it? And hopefully, if I have anything to do with it, I'll be able to arm yoga teachers with the ability to fix it. That's my hope.
Right. And I'd be curious to hear more about your perspective on injury itself and how injury develops, because I feel like sometimes, the common, perspective on it is like, you're fine and then you get injured. But obviously it's not that simple, and there's more of a process. But I'm wondering if, like, by us understanding better how the process of injury actually happens in the body will help us to kind of tune into it in our own bodies, and also for our students, just energetically, if we can see that something's off, we can, understand that at a deeper level, like what's happening.
So you're absolutely right. It's very rare that an injury would happen in the moment. I mean, there are times when that happens, right? Like you fall down the hill skiing, right? And you have massive impact. That's obvious. It could happen then.
Right.
But if someone's in yoga, which is usually occurring, is that their body is, like you've heard of the concept of the onion, like you peel off one layer and then the other shows and then you just keep peeling off layers of the onion. Have you heard that analogy in your classes before?
Of course.
Has anyone ever said that? What's that?
Just a couple of times, yeah.
So what happens there is that originally when the body has an injury, and this is where the initial 20 hours of anatomy really comes in handy. Originally, when the injury occurs, there's a change that occurs in either the muscle spindles or the Golgi tendon organs, and that should be covered in your initial 20 hours of AMP. So once you understand the nature of what those two organisms do in the body, and then you have some more information about how injury is registered, suddenly it starts to make sense. So either the muscle spindles or the Golgi tendon organs respond to trauma or impact. They may lock in place, which then takes the prime movers, which also should come from your initial 20 hours of AMP. It takes the prime movers or the agonists that make that action happen, and it gives it a little vacation. And it calls in the synergists, because now the body still has to move, but the main guy is on vacation. So the buddies, the helpers, the synergists come in, and they start doing the job. But they're not really designed to do that job. They're only there to help out. But the main guy never got back on track because he's been injured, and the body registered that as a memory, so it's kept it there in that injury state. So now all the synergists are working their tail off, and they're getting tired. So then they call in another group of synergists. And the movement actually keeps transferring to several different groups of surrounding synergistic muscles, until the body becomes so fatigued it has no other synergist to call on. That's when it registers as pain. And that process can take weeks and sometimes years. So the good news is that the body is always willing to compensate, right? It will never willingly stay in a state of pain, but it will always instinctively pull out of it, which is great, right? Because we get to keep functioning and, you know, we do all kinds of crazy things to our bodies and we're not in agonizing pain all the time because our body's taking care of it for us. But really what's happening is it's taking care of it in a compensation pattern. It's not taking care of it by way of getting rid of it. It's just storing it and then asking a bunch of other groups to do their job and helping out in the storage. So what yoga can do is it can unravel some of those patterns. And hopefully it can do all of it, but it doesn't always do all of it. Sometimes there needs to be some sort of therapeutic intervention. And for yoga teachers who are skilled at doing therapeutics, they can be that liaison to make that happen. If not, that student who has that layer of their onion revealed and the synergists and the prime movers are coming back to a discussion on who's doing what, and the person's feeling discomfort and or pain, and the yoga teacher can't step in and help out, that person ends up leaving the class thinking they got injured in class, or that yoga is not working for them. And that's where their yoga journey ends, and that's unfortunate.
Right. Yeah, and I think as most of the people on this call know, it's been quite a big topic of conversation in the general, the more mainstream media about yoga and injury, that it's just really more than ever a topic of conversation. So that's why I feel like this call and this topic is so timely, because there is, more, as you were, like you were saying, we could always think of yoga as this healing modality, and now there's all this, quote unquote research, and, people have their issues with it, but like that yoga is causing a lot of injuries and causing a lot of people to suffer in various ways. And, it's definitely a fascinating topic, but also one where I feel like as teachers, it's our responsibility to ensure that at least in our sphere of influence that we're not contributing to that, phenomenon, real or imagined,
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, I know that article that you're talking about, and it did cause...
Yeah, I'd love to get your perspective on that article.
Well... My true feeling about it is that any physical activity, when done in moderation, is fine. And any physical activity that's done in excess can be damaging to the body. So, you know, it sort of suggests that the person participating in their activity have some body awareness. And as yoga teachers, we can offer them that. I mean, that's part of what our physical part of the asana does, combined with the philosophy of yoga that other physical activities don't offer. So do I think that yoga is actually causing the injuries? No. I mean, there's, for example, there's Iyengar and there's Anusara, and those styles of yoga were specifically designed to do the opposite, to take away injury. And it doesn't mean that the other styles of yoga create them. And please don't, you know, make that connection. All yoga is great for the body, and these two branches specifically are designed to go right towards the injury and to remove them. What I think happens, though, is that even though yoga is not causing the injury, a lack of anatomical knowledge could be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, usually Anusara and Iyengar teachers have a lot more anatomy training than perhaps other branches of yoga. And again, it's not pointing fingers at any branch. It's just saying that the more anatomical knowledge you have and the more knowledge you have about injuries and the more you understand compensation patterns and the way the body repatterns, the more readily you're available to help your students to prevent injury in your class, to help them unravel some injuries that they came to you with. Knowledge is power. That's how we make the change. Did that answer it for you?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's. I haven't read. I mean, that article was, I guess, excerpted from a book, and I haven't read the book, so I feel like I should. You know, I can't say too much about it. But I kind of have the same perspective, just that, you know, people engaging in physical activity are always going to put themselves at risk, especially if they don't know how to listen to their own body's signals. You know?
Well, hey, wait though. You know, people who lay on a couch all day are at risk of injuring their bodies too. I mean, there's other
right.
anatomical changes that occur when you don't engage in physical activity. So I don't think
exactly.
that, you know, the answer, yeah. I mean, the answer isn't
yeah.
do all or do nothing. The answer is have awareness and educate yourself. And then when you think you know something, go back and get more education and be a freshman again. You know, humble yourself in a way that you can become the freshman so that you can be more wise and then become the senior and then go back and do it again.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, such an important general principle for teachers, especially as we become, you know, in some ways as we become more experienced, that can be the danger, is like when you really get to know a system well that you've studied, that it's almost, you know, there's this principle called confirmation bias in the psychology world, and we're all susceptible to it. Like even after you know about it, it doesn't matter, that you can't get out of it. And it basically just means that whatever you believe, you're going to selectively choose examples of things to confirm your belief and like not even see the other ones. And I think that's the case in some, you know, for some systems of yoga and therapeutics. It's like you only see the examples that work and you ignore all the ones that don't. So you feel like you're doing, like you're saying you only, when you learn certain things in body work, you could help 6 out of 10 people. But you actually were aware that there were 4 that really still needed help. Whereas in a yoga class, you might see that 6 people are being helped by something and not even notice the other 4 are kind of uncomfortable or maybe putting themselves at risk because you're just not able to see it. You know,
right.
I think as much as we can do our own work to become more aware of what's really happening, and I think that's one of the goals of yoga is, you know, have a deeper awareness of what is, you know, not be an illusion. And I think that there is a lot. I should say there's a lot. There's definitely some of that in the yoga world where people are just like, I know how to heal everything with my system, and they don't notice all the times that it hasn't worked or when people have left their class and never come back because it didn't work for them. You know, it's just I think for all of us as teachers, it's important to not everyone needs to be our student, but to also be aware that there are times when we can be more aware of what's happening in our class and what's not working,
right.
how to serve those people.
That's right. And, you know, when you're talking about, you know, helping the 6 people and missing out on the 4, I think there's a real need to train the eye so that you can pick up on subtleties and, like, be vigilant about that. So one, the way this came to me, actually, was when I was in massage therapy school a long time ago, and my fellow students were talking about people watching. And honestly, at the time, I didn't even know what that term meant. And so I thought you just go and you sit somewhere and you watch people and you try to diagnose them. You know, like if it's, you know, watch them walk from the door and, you know, through the mall, for example, and try to pinpoint whether it's their left ankle or their right knee, or, you know, why is their shoulder high? Is their low back moving? Are their arms swinging equally right to left? And, you know, you only have a couple seconds to do that when you're people watching. Otherwise, they, you know, you kind of get caught mm-hmm. staring.
Right.
But what ended up happening is I really trained my eye to watch subtleties with people. So, you know, kind of like in the animal kingdom, when an animal is suffering, they do their best to stand proud, right, because they don't want to be mm-hmm. someone's prey. And the human body right. does that as well. So what would mm-hmm. happen for me is folks would walk into my treatment room seemingly normal and fine, but I was trained to find the one subtlety that was off that mm-hmm. I could help them, knowing that mm-hmm. their body had already kind of covered that up with compensation patterns, right? It's the nature
right.
of how it goes. So I think the more we train our eye to be able to identify things like that and then have knowledge, anatomical knowledge behind it, so that we can actually speak intelligently and then have training in therapeutics and injuries, then we can help them. Now we've closed the circuit. Now we're experts. Now people come to us because they know they're going to be safe.
Mm-hmm. Right. I would love to know from the people listening in right now live if you have any questions or anything you'd like to have addressed, like maybe something that's happened in one of your classes that you'd like to get Gina's perspective on, or a concern you have about working with people that are injured or having people that are injured in your class or your own injury. So if you want to ask a question, hit 1 on your keypad, and we can unmute you and chat with you. And I think that'd be really great to
hear
from somebody out there. What's that?
I would love that.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing I wanted to share is that before the end of the call, Gina's going to share some really cool stuff that she's offering to people on this call. So please stick around for the end. There's some really cool offers that she has for you to connect with her more fully if you want to learn more. And it's really pretty awesome that she's offering this community what she will be offering. So just, we'll hear about that in a few moments. And I can see that my friend Ted Grand has hit 1. So, Ted, really good to see you on here. And thanks for being on the call.
How are you?
I'm good. Really,
good. Well,
so nice
thanks.
Seeing you on the calls every now and again.
Oh,
and
I
did a green yoga training in LA. Probably, I don't remember. Was it 5 years ago? Something like that.
I think it was about 2 years ago.
2 years ago?
Yeah, something like that. Anyways, I think you're doing a great service. Thank you for this. And just to give some context, I teach a form of hot yoga called Moksha Yoga. We're primarily up in Canada, and recently, there was someone, a public yoga teacher, dissing moksha yoga, saying that practicing in a hot environment makes us more prone to injuries. And I just wanted to see if there was any context or any research that could back that up. And my other question is, do I press 1 again to mute myself?
No, you can stay as you are, and I'll just put you back on mute when we're done, because I don't hear much background noise from you. Are you in a place where you feel like it's relatively quiet?
Yeah, I'm in my home. Well, until my
kids. Okay, yeah, no, it's totally fine. I'll take care of that when we say goodbye to this portion of the call. So just hang out, and you can follow up your question as well.
Great, thank you.
Hi, Ted.
Hi.
Thank you for being on the call tonight. I appreciate your presence. So the first thing that came to mind when you were sharing your experience and then question was that any dissing is not yogic. So, you know, I like to follow that principle of when you're taking advice or information from someone to really understand the source from which it's coming from. And, If it was truly coming to you in a form of dissing, I might even just disregard it completely. But since you have a sincere question about hot yoga, here's what I'll share with you. I think each individual body is unique and different. In fact, I know it. We're all snowflakes. So what works for some people doesn't work for others. And that goes for diet, that goes for hot yoga, that goes for environments. Some people like to live by the water, some people crave the mountains, etc. What I do know about heat in the body is that it does affect the endocrine system in a way that can throw it off balance. So, for example, the endocrine system, you probably remember from your initial 20 hours of AMP, at least I hope so, and its job is to distribute hormones through the body. So it's our own, you know, pharmaceutical distribution center, if you will. And it's affected by a lot of things. It's affected by time of day. It's affected by heat and temperature. It's affected by food, and it's affected by environment. So when one of the glands in the endocrine system is off kilter, meaning it's having too much of something, it affects the rest of the system because it works together as a whole. So what I recommend for folks who are really interested in hot yoga is that they go into it slowly, meaning they don't go from an air-conditioned car and jump into a hot yoga room, and then vice versa. They don't leave a hot yoga class and then go out into 20 below zero in the middle of winter. That if you allow your body to come back to homeostasis, meaning that middle ground, that pulse of neutral, if you can get it to go there more often without extremes, it's healthier for the endocrine system, which is therefore healthier for your hormones, which makes the whole system more concrete.
Wonderful. All the more reason to teach a long shavasana, I guess.
Yes, and cool down the room at that time would be perfect.
Great. Thank you so much for taking my question.
Sure, my pleasure.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks, Tal.
Do you have any follow-up question, or are you good?
You know what? I'd like to ask how things are going with you, but let's save that for a personal call.
Okay, let's do that. I look forward to catching up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks, Ted. So any other questions, you can hit 1 on your keypad. And I would suggest, Gina, if you'd like, you can share a bit about what you'll be offering now for the people on this call. So I feel like a lot of people would be interested in hearing on that, and I know a lot of people, you know, might need to leave towards the end. So maybe we can share about that now and then kind of proceed with questions or with whatever else we want to talk about.
Okay. So we have 2 offers tonight. The first thing is that I have a free gift on my website, which is Ways to Alleviate Pain. And it's a report that I put together, and it's a fantastic way to serve your students. So if you'd like to get that, it's free. Just go onto my website at ginashantz.com and sign up in the lower left corner, and we'll send that out to you right away. And the other thing that's just specific for your listeners tonight on the call, Paul, is that I'm offering a complimentary empowered practitioner session with me. So it's one-on-one with me to talk about what your goals would be and whether you can get them reached through the SHOTS method. And if you're interested, I have 8 spots available for the listeners tonight. And all I need you to do is to email me with your contact information, and we'll set up a conversation to make that happen.
Cool. And what's your email?
The email is theshotsmethod@gmail.com.
Thanks. And just so everyone knows, it's S-C-H-A-T-Z. I hope that's right.
It is right.
Right?
Very good.
Yeah, and Gina, yeah, GINASCHATZ.com. So I hope you'll all check out the free report, and those of you who are interested in possibly learning more, it'd be awesome to take her up on this pre-consultation call. So please do, just for you guys, special offer.
That's right.
I'm really, really glad that you're offering that, and I hope people will take you up on it. So any other questions from those listening in now, please hit 1, and you can ask about anything we cover on this call or something we haven't covered that you're curious about that is relevant. So just hit 1 on your keypad, and I can unmute you, and then we will talk. And while we are waiting for the next question, I'm trying to think what else would be beneficial to cover in the time we have together, Gina. Do you have any? Is there something else that you wanted to share that we haven't had a chance to share yet?
I think some folks might have some curiosity about if I'm available to them. You know, so it sort of comes up when we get to the free gift offer. Mm-hmm. I've had this question come up a lot. When you go to my website, it says I'm in 3 different cities, and it's true that I am. So I'm based right now in New York City, and my roots and my practice are strong in Cleveland, and I teach workshops in both. So I'm available live in both those cities, and as we speak, we're making our way to San Francisco, where I'm also licensed. So we'll be offering the workshops live there as well. But just if you're not in one of those 3 cities, that doesn't mean that we still can't work together. As you and I both know, I work effectively over Skype. So if anyone's thinking that because of their location that the gift doesn't apply to them, it's actually not true. I can reach them pretty much anywhere now, thanks to technology.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. I see that Ted has a follow-up question, so I'm going to unmute him again. And welcome back, Ted.
Thanks. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Had a yoga therapy conference last year and heard something really fascinating by a senior Iyengar teacher about anatomy and injuries. And she was saying that we're in a very rich time right now because so many of the last wave yoga folk are aging now, and some of the injuries from long-term asana practice are coming to the fore. She was saying it particularly as it pertains to pigeon pose. So I was wondering if you've heard anything about what some of the older folks are coming up against as a result of long-term practice, and what the younger folks should be looking out for as a result.
So, Ted, just so I understand your question, are you saying that folks are getting they're having injuries from doing poses over long periods of time, like years and years, and one of the poses is pigeon pose?
Yeah, exactly. They're doing in a particular way, I guess I should say.
Okay, so this particular question excites me, like I want to jump out of my seat. So for those who are, if there's some on the call who are at my last workshop in Cleveland, we just did a workshop on knees. And what ends up happening in pigeon pose in front leg is that the knee is not put in its optimal alignment, which ends up torquing the tibia away from the femur. So the lower leg front bone and the thigh bone. And when that torque happens over time, and you hold pigeon pose traditionally for a long period of time to try to get the hips to open, quote unquote, what ends up happening when you hold a pose for any particular time is that the soft tissue changes, like literally. That's how you get injuries out of the body. But if you don't have the optimal alignment going into the pose and then you hold it, you're actually creating another injury, because you're holding it and making it change. You're making it become injured. So when the front foot in pigeon is sickled, it pulls the tibia away from the femur, and it changes the structure of the knee and all of the other structures, the ACL, the meniscus, etc. That's what they're coming up against. And, you know, also something that you said, Ted, reminded me that we are in a very rich time of education. You know, when I was first into yoga and first into bodywork, it seems like so long ago, I had to really claw my way into further education. And it certainly wasn't available online. It wasn't available by phone. It wasn't available by Skype. I didn't even have a computer when I first went to school, right? I mean, wheels were really round, and I didn't walk uphill both ways without shoes on and that whole bit, but it was still a long time ago. And education wasn't as readily available, and it wasn't accessible. Now, if you're going into any of these healing arts right now, it is prime time. There is a plethora of information available to you in so many ways that it sort of enforces that we become experts at what we do, because we don't have the excuse that the education is not available.
Hmm. And have you heard anything specifically about the older yoga people? I'm sorry, I just can't find the right words to describe them. So. People
who
have been
practicing. Do you mean seniors, or do you mean people who've been doing yoga a long time?
People who've been doing yoga a long time. Are there any injuries that are pretty typical cropping up as a result of long-term asana practice?
There are long-term asana tendencies as far as injury goes. And like I said earlier, that's what I was seeing in my practice as a body worker before I became a yoga teacher. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with age. So, for example, the time that I see people the most right now is when they're in yoga teacher training. That's when they come to me for one-on-one work because they're doing more yoga than they have in their regular routine of yoga. And it's, you know, being forced upon them. You have so many hours, you have to get it in your 200-hour, 500-hour training. And the more repetition you have, the more your injuries show. Like yoga becomes very confrontational in that way. So it doesn't have to be decades and decades, and you don't have to be a certain age for repetition to show up as injury in the body. So you brought up a really good one. Knees suffer a lot from a sickled foot in the front or the back. The number one injury that usually would take my bodywork clients out of yoga permanently is a neck injury. So when they're in bridge pose, for example, and they turn their or shoulder pose, oh my gosh, I get nervous just even thinking about it because I can picture it in my mind. When they're in one of those two poses and they turn their head to the right or the left to see the teacher because they don't really know what they're doing, it puts such a tremendous strain on the posterior side of the neck, and there's so many muscles there, we don't think about it, but there are. And they are not designed to be wrenched like that with weight put on them when the head is in flexion in that way. So what I say to folks when I'm teaching is I'm going to show you bridge if you've never done it before, or I'm going to show you shoulder stand if you've never done it before. We're going to slow it down right now so you have time to look. If when you get up there you get a little disoriented and you forgot what to do, please do not turn your head to the right or left to find me. Bring your body down. You know, I use the word don't very selectively in class, but when they're in that pose, I say don't turn to the right or the left. You will hurt your neck. So those two stand out to me as biggies, the knee and the neck.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
Cool. Thanks, Ted. Thanks for your questions. Appreciate you sharing. And I'd love to hear from some of the other people on the call as well. One question I have for you, Gina, based on what you just said, is, you know, what you often hear in classes, and I feel like I've probably said this when I'm teaching too, is like, you know, if it's feeling good, then that means it's good for you. Like, you know, like if you're in a pose, let's just say you're in pigeon pose and it's like feeling good, then that means it's good for you. But is there a way in which we can do poses and they'll feel good to us, but yet we're actually going to be contributing to an injury longer term?
Yes. So, for example, when you're in pigeon pose and your front foot is sickled, that usually feels good.
Mm-hmm.
Long-term, that creates knee injury.
Mm-hmm.
Non-reversible knee injury, by the way, because when you make changes to other structures in the body that aren't muscles, it's very challenging to get them back.
Mm-hmm.
When you overstretch the ligament or a tendon, getting the elasticity back in those tissues is an arduous task. So, yeah, pigeon pose can feel great, but that doesn't mean we're doing it properly. And, you know, the reverse is also true, Tal, right? So like we said earlier, the body will never willingly go through discomfort and pain, and it certainly won't hold it there. That's why, you know, there's some endurance that comes when we're in a yoga class where we're like, you know, hold the pose, 5 more breaths. And you're like, oh, my gosh, there is no way. If I wasn't standing here in a room with 30 other people, I would be out of this pose lickety-split. There's no way I'd be holding it this long. So there's something that comes from holding it. When you are in optimal alignment and you are holding a pose for a minute and 30 seconds or longer, you are creating change. You're peeling away those layers of the onion. But your body will never instinctively do that on its own. Instinctively, it'll pull away from that discomfort because it's discomfort.
Huh.
So the more you know about functional...
Yeah, can you say more about that minute and 30 seconds? I'm curious about that. I mean, I've heard things like 10 breaths, and I'm just curious about the minute and 30 seconds.
Yeah, so there's some scientific data behind what happens with tissues in the body, including fascia, right? Like we love to talk about fascia. And so the data shows that if you hold a lengthened tissue, and notice I didn't say stretch, because stretch is actually a phenomenon that doesn't really occur. It's opposite action. But when you hold a lengthened tissue in the body for a minute and 30 seconds, that's typically the time that it takes for the correct firing to occur in that muscle, in the muscle spindles, and for the message to go to and from the brain to that muscle to make the change happen. And then it can be more long-standing. If you're only holding poses for very short periods of time, you're going through current range of motion. That doesn't mean, I'm not saying that every class you should hold a pose for 5 minutes. There's something really powerful about a quick vinyasa class, but that is not a time when you're going to be making changes in tissue length in a quick vinyasa class. You make those changes in a longer held hatha class.
Interesting.
But so, only if you're in optimal alignment.
Right. So I feel like I've had this experience, and I don't think I'm alone in this. Like when I did a lot of, you know, more flowy vinyasa stuff, I often felt kind of a rubber band effect where I felt pretty open in the class because I got really hot. But then when, like, the next day I'd wake up, I'd be super, like, tight and like, oh, my God, I can barely walk, you know, because every single muscle is just, like, contracted feeling. Is that part of that because I didn't hold it for a minute and 30 seconds, that it was just a temporary feeling of opening?
Well, it could be a couple of things, right? So like Ted was asking about the hot yoga class earlier. One of the things that does occur in a hotter yoga class from a muscle perspective is that we can feel like we can get into a pose deeper than maybe what our tissues are ready for because the heat gives them a sensation of being warmed up and that the muscle spindles are actually firing at a different rate. So you could have gone too quickly and not been warmed up enough, even if the class felt hot. The other thing is that when you make changes to muscle spindles, like when you're working out with weights and you're enduring weight, you're breaking them down a little bit, you're making changes in them, and that can feel like sore the next day, even though you know you did a good workout, you didn't lift too much weights, you still made changes in your tissues, and that's sore after you've been back to the gym for the first time in a long time. That could have been what was happening. Or it could have been that you weren't holding them long enough and you actually weren't making changes. You just got sore from doing the workout.
Great. So I have another question here. I have some more personal questions if no one else has questions, but there is one question here, so I'm going to let them chime in and not be totally selfish. But now I'm all like, oh, I have questions. Okay, so Kimberly, you're live with us. Thanks for calling in. And hi.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Hi, Kimberly.
Good. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I have a question. Given everything that you just said about you know, long holds and especially pigeon, I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on a yin practice.
Especially on what type of practice?
Yin.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since, you know, in the yin practice, they're traditionally asked to, you know, not hold on to any muscular tension, so there's not a whole big emphasis on alignment. So I'm curious, you know, how that plays in the body, especially since we hold those poses for so long, sometimes, you know, 3 to 5 minutes.
Right, so that's a great question. So one of the things to consider when deciding on a yin practice is whether or not someone's got a normal range of mobility or if they're hypermobile. And when I'm teaching my 20 hours of A&P, we actually do a test on that so that you know where you stand. And sometimes more flexibility is not better. It makes for a beautiful yoga pose, but it doesn't necessarily equal health of the tissue. So I'm one of those people who's hypermobile, and a yin practice for me is not comfortable because what ends up happening when you're hypermobile is that your connective tissue, your ligaments and your tendons, don't have as much elasticity as they could. So my bones can move more freely than somebody else who has normal ranges of mobility. So when I'm in a yin practice, because you're not using muscle effort, as you mentioned, Kimberly, what you are addressing is lengthening connective tissue, aka ligaments and tendons. So for someone who's muscle bound, like a football player type body, someone who's more bulky, yin would be perfect for them because not only can they get their muscles addressed through other yoga practices, but in the yin practice, they can also have their connective tissue released, which allows them more access to their muscle tissue. For someone who's hypermobile like me, a yin practice is not indicated.
Right. So then how do you go about a yin practice? And like you said, for in pigeon pose, you know, whenever, you know, like I said, you have to be muscularly soft, right? So the feet are naturally going to sickle because you're not flexing them in using your muscles. So then how do you prevent, you know, like that irreversible knee damage that you had just mentioned?
Not easily, right? I mean,
yeah.
So it's part of like the more you know, the more powerful you can be as a teacher. So I don't teach yin practice, and obviously because I've just explained to you what my own personal body preferences are, I don't take it either. But if it were me and I were teaching a yin practice, I would either teach the pigeon pose for not as long as you're suggesting that they're usually held for, or I would try to find another hip opener where the foot didn't need to be stickled. But, you know, I mean, flexing the foot and keeping the ankles, the malleoli, square with the knee may require some muscle effort at the beginning, but I'm wondering in yin if you could use some props that might help that stabilize so that you're not actually engaging the tissues. And if that's not the case, then I would find another hip opener.
Right, okay. Yeah, I think my bigger question is it a safe practice? You know, in the community, I hear more and more people talk about doing yin, and they love it because it's relaxing and surrendering and this and that. But then I've also heard a lot of people talking about, you know, low back pain and sciatica and stuff like that, and I just wonder if the two are related.
Well, it's similar to Ted's question, right? Like, it's not right for everybody, and
right.
The more you know as a yoga teacher, the more you can guide someone. So, for example, if I was teaching a yin practice and I had someone come in and I could tell out of the gate they were hypermobile, it would be impossible for me to let them take the class without at least informing them of what I know about yin and what I know about their hypermobility. And I might even take them through the 9-point flexibility test and let them know and then give them some information. And then, you know, invite them to come. Like, one class of yin is not going to, you know, damage my body forever, right? I've taken it. And I took it, and it was lovely, and I appreciate the teacher, and it wasn't for me. But for the people that it is for, all of the things that you mentioned are wonderful. Right, just like there's beautiful things about a hot yoga class too. There's beautiful things about vinyasa. There's beautiful things about Iyengar, and they're all wildly different from each other. If someone's really able to access their true surrender and relaxation, that's powerful. You know,
right.
That's not
yeah, I agree.
Away from them. And I don't think that, you know, I have to be really careful here. Right? It's kind of like what happened in the world of body work, where everybody was like, oh, you know, that modality is not really great, and that teacher's not qualified, and this and what's that? What's that? In the yoga world, we know better than to talk like that, right?
Right.
Yin practice is just as effective as any other, but it's not for everyone. And the more we know from an anatomical perspective, the more we can make that discernment on the behalf of our students and educate them to a better choice.
Okay, great. Thank you. I appreciate
sure,
it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Kim. That was a really great question. You know, and I think, Gina, it goes back to what you mentioned in the beginning. It's like it's the same thing in the yoga world that we have in the world of nutrition and diet. It's like everyone's like, you have to do this diet. Like, I don't even care who you are. It's just like everyone has to do this. Whereas for every single individual, it's like they have their own unique needs for what they need to eat to feel great. You know, and
right.
I think we somehow forget that in our yoga world. We're like, no, but my style of yoga is the best, and all my friends have to do it, and everyone I know has to do it, instead of looking at what kind of body type they have and having some more objective measures that, like, how do we blend our passion with a little bit more dispassion, a little more objectivity, being like, is this actually, like what you're saying about yin? I love yin because I'm super, like, you know, bulky and tight in a way. I'm not, like, a huge guy. You've met me, but, like, I definitely have tight, you know, connective tissue. So it feels good for me. But yeah, I can totally get that it's not good for everybody. So I think it's really important for us to make.
Right, and this topic is so important, Tal, right? Like, so I believe that in answer to your global question, how do we blend our passion with our objectivity? By having more knowledge, right? So it used to, way back in the day, it used to irritate me when I'd hear dialogue like that, and now when I hear someone saying, oh, no, it has to be this way, it has to be that way, and there's someone in the service industry, yoga teacher, body worker, nutritionist, you know, all of us, what I'm hearing them say is that they want to be of service.
Oh,
they
totally.
Really want
yeah.
to be of service. They're passionately involved in being of service. So
because,
those
because
people
it works
who are
for them.
Passionate, well, not always. I mean, it could just be that they saw it work for someone else and they want that result for everybody that comes to them. So what I say to those people is take your passion and involve yourself in some continuing education so that you can get more data, more facts, more information, more richness, more tools in your toolbox so that you can direct that passion so that you can be objective for the person in front of you instead of talking to the whole world as if it applies to everyone. And then you know, you channel the passion, and that's how you blend it, and then they can still be of service. right? So in my workshops, we talk about that, right? Like, it doesn't matter what philosophy you have personally about your own life. It doesn't matter what type of yoga you teach. If you're trying to help people with injuries, whether it's in a yin practice or in a hot yoga practice or in a hatha practice, there's still some universal knowledge that has to be distributed to the yoga community, the teachers in particular, about injuries, about patterning, about compensation in the body, about how they occur, so that regardless of what type of yoga you're teaching, you can safely take someone through a class without injury and possibly, hopefully, even help them with some of their pre-existing injuries.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a grand vision, and I really I salute you for, you know, bringing your part of that into the world. And I'm like, you know, super excited for the people who are listening in on this live and on the recording that might eventually work with you and be part of that movement as well, because it's just you know, such a needed thing now, especially given that this is now part of the mainstream conversation about yoga is injury. And so I think as teachers are more empowered around it and can speak about it more intelligently and with the hours of training behind them and developing that eye you spoke about, like, it's just going to be so much more inviting for people to be in those kinds of classes. And I think, you know, with the massive popularity of yoga, and this is not a negative thing, it's just part of what's happened, I think there's just been a lot of teachers out there where their enthusiasm has overridden their objectivity, you know, or their ability to discern and be effective about what's good for somebody or not. And so I think maybe this is like a corrective wave of, you know, that you're part of, is like, let's actually really do this stuff. That's not necessarily easy. Like, learning anatomy, for me at least, wasn't easy. It was one of the hardest things I ever did, in a way, harder than college courses or so. But, you know, so rewarding. And so I really hope that people listening to this call will get re-engaged with that if they haven't been doing that and realize how important it is for their students. That it's not just a spiritual, you know, journey, but it's also a physical journey, and knowing the body is really a part of it.
That's true, and you can't really separate the physical from the spiritual, right? Because our spirit is contained within the physical body. And, you know, you mentioned something really interesting, Tal, when you said that teachers need to discern. I think what's happening now with the abundance of yoga teachers in the world right now, and how, you know, widely spread it is throughout our country, for, you know, specifically speaking about us, students are also becoming more discerning, right? So there's more teachers to choose from. There's more studios to choose from. There's more class options for them. So they're becoming more discerning as well, which means you really need to have a specialty and have a unique niche as a yoga teacher so that you can attract the right students to you and so that they know that if they're looking for what you have, that they go to you and not get lost in 13 other studios around the city. Right.
Absolutely.
So if therapeutics and orthopedics and injury and that type of thing is for you, then hone your continuing education towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Come take a workshop with us, because everybody that's in the classes with us are all working on the same niche. So it's great stuff.
Right. Yeah, and it's definitely what you're saying is, you know, something that has come up again and again in these calls is this idea that as we step into our fullness as teachers, it's not that every single teacher is going to be as knowledgeable as anatomy as you. That may not be their specialty, but that there's something that they're offering that's really unique to them. And so, you know, as we can all discover that's going to attract the kind of students that are really needing that. And the students that need something else are going to find those teachers because they're sharing about their passion for, you know, let's just say it's anatomy and orthopedics and injury, you know, rehabilitation. That we need it all, you know, and so trying to be everything to everyone, like saying your yoga style is everything to everyone, just not true, and it doesn't really work, and it actually creates more confusion than it does clarity for students. And you know, I'm totally behind what you're saying, is that we all, like, having a niche is, like, sometimes sounds like, but then I'm limiting myself, and da-da-da. But it's actually like you're enhancing your ability to impact more people in a much bigger way, rather than just having you can have a very like small impact on a lot of people just by doing, you know, something that everyone can enjoy in a way. But if you're really doing something for specific people, you can really change their lives in a very powerful way and create you know, people that will follow you for years and years and years and years and become your dedicated students and friends, which is, I think, what most of us really want to create if we're not already creating.
Absolutely.
That. You know, and I know
Absolutely.
That. So, awesome. Well, it's 10 after the hour, and so I want to honor your time, Gina. If there is another question, this is a speak now or forever hold your peace kind of moment, even though I have so many more things I'd love to ask you about just from the perspective of, like, how the body works, and I'd love to learn more from you, but maybe we can do that another time. I just want to thank you for your time on the call today. It's been really fascinating and fun and informative and engaging, and kind of reawakened my love for how the body works and fascination with it that I haven't been fully immersing myself in. I'm doing this work more around creating educational opportunities for teachers and coaching teachers and working on the business side of things, but definitely something that I've always been very, very curious about. So thank you for that.
Oh, that's terrific, Tal. That if it awakened your love of anatomy even a little tiny bit, I feel like this whole call was completely successful.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really hope that I hear back from some people or hear back from you that some people who listened to this call went out and study with you because they already are near Cleveland or New York or San Francisco. And I look forward to seeing you again when you are in San Francisco. Hopefully I'll be in town.
Yes, it will be very soon, Tal. We'll definitely get together.
Yeah. When will that be? What time of year?
Our San Francisco dates aren't completely scheduled yet. The next, but they are available online. So as the San Francisco dates come up, like I said, we're just reaching San Francisco as we speak. Very next workshop, by the way, is the 9th of September, and that one will be in Cleveland. And the one after that will be in New York. And again, that's all on the website.
Right. So it's GinaShaps.com. Is that right?
That's right. Yep.
Okay. So go to GinaShaps.com. Remember, you can get the free report on reducing pain. And also, if you're interested in one of the 8 free consultations with Gina, to send her an email right away to let her know you're interested in that, and you guys can set that up. So I'm going to end the call now. And thanks again so much to all of you for being part of this call. And those of you listening to the recording, thanks for listening in. I hope you got a lot out of it. Gina, thanks. See you again, and I look forward to connecting with you more in the future.
Paul, thank you so much. It was great. I appreciate your support.
My pleasure. Really glad we got to connect. Bye, everyone. Please let me know what you thought of the call, and look forward to seeing you on future calls as well. Bye-bye.
Good night.